Welcome to Historical Nerdery, the show that destroys the myths of the American Revolution, one podcast at a time. I am your head nerd, Alexander Kane. On today's season one finale, we're going to explore what really happened at the Battle of Lexington and how a militia captain was able to rally his defeated troops and inspire them to return to the bloody fight of April 19th, 1775. I hope you will join us today on Historical Nerdery. Let's get into the show. As discussed in Episode 4, when Parliament passed the Boston Port Bill in an attempt to break the Massachusetts colonists of their resistance to crown policy, it also authorized General Thomas Gage to undertake any military measures necessary to help bring the colony under control. On September 1, 1774, General Gage ordered a picked force of his regulars to seize the largest supply of gunpowder in the colony. The raid started at 4:30 in the morning and was successfully completed by first light. 5 months later, on February 26, 1775, 240 men of the 64th Regiment of Foot landed in Marblehead and marched to Salem with orders to seize cannons located within the seaside town. Unlike the September 1st raid of the previous year, the colonists of Essex County were aware of the object of the mission from the outset. Militia and minute companies from the surrounding communities quickly mobilized. After a tense standoff with the Salem militia, the regulars were forced to return to Boston empty-handed. In late winter and early spring of 1775, General Gage received a series of dispatches from London ordering him to not only arrest the leaders of Massachusetts opposition party, but to launch a major military strike against the apparently growing provincial stockpiles of weapons and munitions. After reviewing his options, the general decided instead to seize the military supplies reportedly stored at Concord. It appears General Gage's primary desire when drafting his orders was the recovery of four brass cannons. On the eve of the American Revolution, brass cannons were considered weapons of mass destruction. They were light, easily maneuverable, and deadly. In September of 1774, four brass cannons were stolen while under guard by Boston residents and smuggled out of the town. In February of 1775, the Massachusetts Provincial Congress reported that these guns were located in Concord. The next month, General Gage's informants confirmed that the pieces were concealed at Mr. B., lately chose or appointed minute colonel, supposed to be deposited in his cellar. General Gage's plan called for approximately 700 men, composed of the elite grenadiers and light infantry from several regiments and a company of Marines, to march from Boston to Concord under cover of darkness on April 18, 1775. This strike force was under the command of Lieutenant Colonel Francis Smith of the 10th Regiment of Foot and Major John Pitcairn of the Marines. Unfortunately for Gage, his carefully prepared plans did not carry through as he expected. As the operation date neared, the general unintentionally sent a series of warning signs to the Boston populace that a raid into the countryside was about to occur. As Lieutenant Mackenzie correctly noted, the people of the country are extremely jealous of these movements, and some of them constantly attend, apparently to observe if there is any particular object in view, and to convey intelligence if necessary. Throughout March and April of 1775, British regiments were ordered to repair camp equipment and gear. On April 5th, the Royal Navy, at Gage's request, began to prepare for a movement of troops by water. 2 days later, transport boats were launched and repaired in full view of civilian onlookers. On April 10th, the 38th and 52nd Regiments of Foot marched out as far as Watertown and did not return to Boston till 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Finally, on April 15th, General Gage ordered the Grenadier and Light Infantry Companies to be off duty till further orders, as they will be ordered out to learn the Grenadier exercise and some evolutions for the Light Infantry. From observing this conduct, Massachusetts civilians correctly anticipated that a major military operation was about to be set in motion. On April 18, 1775, that anticipation became reality. As Solomon Brown, an 18-year-old Lexington boy, was returning home from the market in Boston on the evening of April 18, 1775, He had no idea he was about to stumble across the advance guard of a British force bound for Concord. About 6 o'clock that evening, as he neared Lexington, he spotted 9 British officers riding slowly along the country road before him. The evening was not very cold, yet Brown noted that each of the officers was wearing a heavy wool blue overcoat, under which he could see the shape of their pistols. Taken aback, Brown passed the officers and galloped on to Lexington. He rode directly to Monroe's tavern, where he informed Sergeant William Monroe of what he had observed. In turn, Sergeant Monroe quickly dispatched a detail to guard the provincial leaders, John Hancock and Samuel Adams, both of whom had taken up temporary residence a short distance up the Bedford Road from the tavern, in the home of Reverend Clark. According to Sergeant Monroe, these men were placed around the house of Mr. Clark for the night, and I remained with them. By 9 o'clock that evening, after the party of British officers had been observed riding through Lexington, 30 members of Captain John Parker's militia company assembled outside of Buckman's Tavern. Among those present were Solomon Brown, Jonathan Loring, and Elijah Sanderson. An older member of the militia company encouraged the three to locate the 9 officers and ascertain their objective. The young men agreed to set out on their horses. Sanderson and Loring were charged with the task of observing the British movements, while Brown would ride ahead to Concord to alert the town. Half an hour later, the three were captured in Lincoln by the 9 officers. According to one period account, we were, about 10 of the clock, suddenly surprised by 9 persons, whom we took to be regular officers, who rode up to us, mounted and armed, each having a pistol in his hand, and after putting pistols to our breast and seizing the bridles of our horses, they swore that if we stirred another step, we should all be dead men, upon which we surrendered ourselves. About 2 hours later, alarm rider Paul Revere rode into Lexington. He galloped past Monroe's Tavern, crossed the bridge at Vinebrook, and then on to Buckman's Tavern. After a brief conversation with the men there, he rode the few hundred yards up the Bedford Road to the Clark Parsonage. As he dismounted, Revere encountered Sergeant Monroe and his armed guard. Monroe, not recognizing the rider, called for Revere to identify himself and ordered him not to make so much noise as people inside the house were trying to sleep. The agitated Revere shouted, "Noise? You'll have enough noise before long. The regulars are coming out." Storming past the sergeant, he began banging on the front door of the parsonage. Hancock immediately lifted the sash of his bedroom window to see what was happening. Recognizing Paul Revere, he exclaimed, "Come in, Revere. We're not afraid of you." Revere hastily entered the home and informed Adams and Hancock that the regulars had left Boston and were probably at that moment marching towards Lexington. Shortly afterwards, a second alarm rider, William Dawes, arrived to confirm Revere's report. According to the Reverend Clark, who wrote later, between the hours of 12 and 1 in the morning of the 19th of April, we received intelligence by express from the intelligence service, the Honorable Joseph Warren, Esquire, at Boston, that a large body of the King's troops, supposed to be a brigade of about 1,200 or 1,500, were embarked in boats from Boston and gone over to land at Lake Marispoint, so-called, in Cambridge. Revere, Dawes, Adams, Hancock, and Clark left the minister's parsonage and walked down the Bedford Road to Buckman's Tavern to speak with the officers of the training band. According to Clark, the conversation centered on the purpose of the British mission, and after some debate, it was concluded that the goal of capturing Adams and Hancock was at best secondary. Instead, it was shrewdly suspected that they were ordered to seize and destroy the stores of arms belonging to the colony, then deposited at Concord, in consequence of General Gage's unjustifiable seizure of the provincial magazine of powder at Medford and other colony stores in several other places. With no word from Brown, Loring, or Sanderson, it was deemed necessary to try to again carry the warning to Concord. Revere and Dawes immediately set out, and as they galloped away from the town at about 1:30 in the morning, Lexington's alarm bell began to toll out its warning. As we discussed in the last episode, the women and children of Lexington fled the vicinity of the town common shortly after the alarm bell started to ring. Meanwhile, as the Reverend Clark recalled, upon this timely intelligence, the militia of this town were alarmed and ordered to meet on the usual place of parade. As the Lexington militia gathered, Captain John Parker addressed his men so as to consult what might be done for our own and the people's safety, and also to be ready for whatever service Providence might call us out to upon this alarming occasion. After some discussion, it was decided to confirm the accuracy of Revere's message by sending scouts eastward to locate and observe the movements of the British regulars. Two persons were sent express to Cambridge to gain intelligence on the motions of the troops and what route they took. The militia met according to order and waited the return of the messengers that they might order their measures as occasion should require. The two scouts traveled along separate routes and were gone for several hours. One of the two returned between 3 and 4 o'clock in the morning and reported that there was no appearance of the troops on the roads to Cambridge and Charlestown, and that the movements of the army were but a feint to alarm the people. Believing Revere was mistaken, Parker dismissed his men, but with orders to be within call of the drum, waiting the return of the other messenger, who was expected in about an hour or sooner, if any discovery should be made of the motions of the troops. Some of the militia went home, but many walked across the village common to Buckman's Tavern. Before entering, they discharged their muskets into the air. Meanwhile, Revere and Dawes were expecting some difficulty of their own. According to Revere, he was captured by the same officers who had caught Brown, Sanderson, and Loring earlier. Revere was subjected to a series of interrogations, and as the evening wore on, the questioning intensified into open threats of violence. According to Revere, one of them, whom I since learned was Major Mitchell of the 5th Regiment, clapped his pistol to my head and said he was going to ask me some questions, and if I did not tell the truth, he would blow my brains out. I told him I esteemed myself a man of truth, that he had stopped me on the highway and made me a prisoner. I knew not by what right I would tell him the truth. I was not afraid. As the questioning continued, Revere fed the officers a good deal of misinformation. He began by telling the officers I knew what they were after, that I had alarmed the country all the way up, and that their boats were caught aground, and I should have 500 men there soon. He warned them that the countryside was alarmed, and if they remained in the vicinity of Lexington, they would be in extreme danger. The 9 officers were shaken by Revere's information. They were almost 16 miles from Boston, and according to their captive, in the midst of hostile territory. The officers quickly remounted, ordered their captives to do the same, and warned their prisoners, "We are now going towards your friends, and if you attempt to run, or if we are insulted, we will blow your brains out." The 9 officers formed a circle, placed their 4 prisoners in the center of it, and hurried back towards Lexington. When they were 1/2 mile from the village common, a gunshot rang out. Major Mitchell demanded clarification, and when Revere informed him that it was to alarm the country, Mitchell ordered that the 4 prisoners to dismount. Then one of the officers dismounted and cut the bridles and saddles off the horses and drove them away. I asked the major to dismiss me. He said he could carry me, let the consequences be what they will. He then ordered us to march. As the party neared the village common, they began to hear the alarm bell clanging rapidly. A few moments later, the riders were startled by the musket fire from the direction of Buckman's Tavern. Loring, following Revere's lead, turned to his captors and exclaimed, "The bells are ringing, the town's alarmed, and you're all dead men." Recognizing the gravity of the situation, Mitchell quickly consulted with his fellow officers. Afterwards, the officers approached the 3 Lexington men and released them. As for Revere, Mitchell asked me how far it was to Cambridge and many more questions, which I answered. He then asked the sergeant if his horse was tired. The sergeant said yes. Mitchell ordered him to take my horse. I dismounted, and the sergeant mounted my horse. They cut the bridle and saddle of the sergeant's horse and rode off down the road. Revere and the others left the road and waded through the swamp, through mud and water, hoping to arrive at the meeting house before the officers could pass to give information to the militia. But Major Mitchell and his fellow officers fled too quickly to be captured, riding through Lexington at breakneck speed, stopping only briefly before the meeting house, and then galloping off towards Cambridge. When Revere and the others arrived at the tavern, Sanderson observed that some citizens were coming and going. Some went down to find whether the British were coming. Some came back and said there was no truth to it. Young Sanderson quickly refreshed himself with a drink, slumped into a chair by the fire, and fell asleep. Revere, however, went directly to the Clark residence to ensure that Hancock and Adams had left Lexington. Upon discovering that the two had not, he quickly ushered them into a heavy coach and dispatched them to Woburn. As the two rode away, Hancock's clerk, John Lowell, approached Revere. He hurriedly informed the alarm rider that his employer had forgotten a large trunk in the upper chamber of Buckman's Tavern. Recognizing the potential intelligence windfall if the documents fell into Gage's hands, the two raced down Bedford Road and returned to the tavern. As Revere and Lowell entered, Thaddeus Bowman, the second scout sent out earlier in the morning, came galloping up Boston Road. Reining in his horse at Buckman's Tavern, he shouted to Captain John Parker that the regulars were less than a half hour away. Parker immediately summons the militia's 19-year-old drummer, William Diamond. Diamond, who as a child worked in a tavern in Cambridge before taken in as an apprentice by Lexington Abijah Fessenden, allegedly had been taught to play the drum by a British soldier. That morning, as signal guns were fired and the alarm bell rang, the teenage drummer, in an answer to Parker's command, began to beat the call to arms. Militiamen converged on the village common from all directions. Revere and Lowell ran up the tavern stairs to the second floor to recover Hancock's trunk. The two men, according to Revere, made haste and had to pass through our militia, who were on a green behind the meeting house, to the number, as I supposed, about 50 or 60. Once clear of the militia, the two men made a desperate dash for a line of woods adjacent to the common and out of harm's way. As they fled into the woods, Sergeant William Monroe was assembling the men into ranks near the meeting house. Captain John Parker then ordered his company to the right about face and marched them a further 75 yards away from the meeting house and from the road to Concord. When the company had covered the distance, he ordered his men to halt and execute a second right about face, which left them somewhat to the rear of the common and facing the meeting house. Parker then turned to his men and said, "Let the troops pass by and don't molest them without they begin first." As the company stood waiting, more militiamen continued to file onto the common. The precise number that actually made it onto the field by the time of the battle is in dispute. Some give the figure of 77 as commemorated on the battle site monument, but not all those so enumerated actually were standing in formation on the common. The number in ranks may have been as low as some 30 to 40 odd. As the growing thunder of drums and marching feet began to echo across the common, the militiamen began to stir and look cautiously about. The regulars were out, and Captain John Parker's company was directly in their path. Understandably, the regular soldiers and the officers marching towards the Lexington militia were in a foul mood. The troops and Loyalist guides had started crossing the Charles River from Boston by boat at 10 o'clock in the evening. For the next 2 hours, the entire expedition stood in the freezing marshes of Phipps Farm until rations that they did not need arrived and were handed out. When the expedition finally got underway at 2 o'clock in the morning, Colonel Francis Smith soon realized that the entire countryside seemed to know of its existence. As he reported days later, "Notwithstanding, we marched with the utmost expedition and secrecy, yet we found the country had intelligence or strong suspicion of our coming, and fired many signal guns and rung alarm bells repeatedly." Realizing that the expedition was running behind schedule and that the success of the mission was in jeopardy, Smith halted the column upon reaching Menotomy. There, he gave his men a short rest and summoned Major Pitcairn. He ordered the Marine to take 6 companies of light infantry and march with all expedition to seize the 2 bridges on different roads beyond Concord. Pitcairn set off immediately, pushing his detachment hard, and sent forward an advance guard consisting of Lieutenant Jesse Adair of the Royal Marines, Loyalist guide Daniel Murray, and several other officers and 8 light infantrymen. As Pitcairn's force mobilized, the advance guard captured 2 men on horseback, Asahel Porter and Josiah Richardson of Woburn. As the 2 riders were taken into custody, signal guns and alarm bells began to sound. Hearing the alarms, Lieutenant Colonel Smith ordered an officer to return to Boston to request reinforcements. Meanwhile, at the front of Pitcairn's column, the sound of many galloping horses was heard, and into the ranks of advance guard rode Major Mitchell's party, which had earlier captured Revere and the 3 Lexington riders. As Lieutenant William Sutherland of the 38th Regiment of Foot remembered, "We were joined by Major Mitchell, and several other gentlemen who told us the whole countryside was alarmed and had galloped for their lives, or words to that purpose. Yet, Pitcairn was determined to still press ahead. As the expedition advanced, a third alarm rider, Simon Winship of Lexington, was captured. However, unlike his two predecessors, he refused to dismount and had to be dragged off of his horse. The column encountered other individuals on the road that morning, both on horse and foot. Each of them, when questioned by the officers, emphasized that a large body of militia had gathered in Lexington and would resist the regulars if they continued their march to Concord. As the column crossed into Lexington, Lieutenant Sutherland, who was with the advance guard, physically collided with Benjamin Wellington, a 31-year-old Lexington resident who was fully armed and equipped for war. Wellington was forced to surrender his musket, cartridge box, and bayonet, and then was ordered to go home. Instead, Wellington ignored the instructions and hurried back to the village common. He rearmed himself with another musket from the town's stock. As the column closed in on Lexington's common, a British sergeant reported that a party of colonial horsemen rode out from the village and shouted, "You had better turn back, for you shall not enter the town." One of the mounted men, according to a period account, then presented a musket and attempted to shoot them, but the piece flashed in the pan. According to Lieutenant Sutherland, another individual fired at him from the vicinity of Buckman's Tavern. He reported this to Pitcairn, who had then galloped to the front of the column, halted the men, and ordered them to load their muskets and fix bayonets. He then ordered, "On this, I gave directions to the troops to move forward, but on no account to fire or even attempt it without orders." Off in the distance, militiamen could be seen hurrying into line. According to another period account, "The road before you go into Lexington is level for about 1,000 yards. When we came up to the main body, which appeared to me to exceed 400 in and about the village, who were drawn up in a plain opposite the church." Captain Parker's men waited nervously for the arrival of the British regulars. As the troops approached, many began to realize the danger that they were in. One was bold enough to tell Parker, "There are so few of us, it is folly to stand here." The militia captain, ignoring the outcry, turned to his company and stated, "Let the troops pass by, and don't molest them without they begin first." Pitcairn was confronted with a military quandary. If he chose to ignore the militia company drawn up on the village common, he would be leaving an armed opponent to his rear. If he halted, he could exacerbate an already tense situation. Of course, the light infantry officers in the lead company of the column, the 4th Regiment of Foot, resolved Pitcairn's dilemma by directing their men directly towards the Lexington militia. The next light infantry company, from the 10th Regiment of Foot, quickly followed. These two companies raced towards the increasingly nervous militia. Suddenly, they deployed into a line of battle and began to shout, "Huzzay!" Lieutenant Edward Gould of the 4th Regiment of Foot later testified that he could not hear above the noise his men were making. According to Sutherland, several officers began to shout, "Throw down your arms and you shall come by no harm." Private James Marr of the 4th Foot believed Pitcairn exclaimed, "Stop, you rebels." However, many of the Lexington militiamen later asserted that the officers shouted, "Lay down your arms, damn you, why don't you lay down your arms?" Recognizing that the situation was becoming more and more dangerous, Captain Parker turned to his men and issued new orders. According to his affidavit after the battles of Lexington and Concord, "I immediately ordered our militia to disperse and not to fire." Most of the men obeyed his command and began to file off the common. Some, however, either did not hear Parker's order or chose to ignore it. As a result, several Lexington men held their ground as the light infantry surged forward. Suddenly, a single shot rang out. Revere, who was still in the woods with Lowell, said he later could not determine the source of the shot. Lieutenant Edward Gould also stated he could not determine where the shot came from. Many of the British officers believed the provincial fired at them. Major Pitcairn reported that some of the rebels who had jumped over the wall fired 4 or 5 shot at the soldiers, which wounded a man of the 10th, and my horse was wounded in 2 places from some quarter or the other. And at the same time, several shot were fired from a meeting house on our left. According to William Sutherland, "Instantly, some of the villains who got over the hedge fired at us, which our men for the first time returned fire." Even Lieutenant Colonel Smith, who was not present, asserted, "Our troops advanced towards them without any intention of injuring them, further than to inquire the reason of their being assembled, and if not satisfactory, to have secured their arms." But they, in confusion, went off, principally to the left. Only one of them fired before he went off, and three or four more jumped over a wall and fired from behind it among the soldiers, on which the troops returned it. Months later, as he lay dying from the wound sustained at Bunker Hill, Major Pitcairn again spoke of the Battle of Lexington. According to Ezra Stiles, Pitcairn asserted that he was riding up to them. He ordered them to disperse, which they did not do instantly. He turned about and ordered his troops to draw out so as to surround and disarm them. As he turned, he saw a gun in a peasant's hand from behind a wall, a flash in the pan without going off, and instantly, or very soon, two or three guns went off. The guns he did not see, but believing they could not come from his own people, and that thus they began the attack. From the provincial point of view, the first shot was from the king's army. Simon Winship described an officer on horseback, flourishing his sword and with a loud voice giving the word, "Fire! Fire!" which was instantly followed by a discharge of arms from the said regular troops. Nathan Monroe contradicted William Sutherland when he stated he stumbled over a wall into John Buckman's land, about 6 rods from the British, and then turned and fired at the regulars only after they had fired at him first. Clark insisted one of the mounted officers with the expedition fired the first shot. The second of these officers, about this time, fired a pistol towards the militia as they were dispersing. The foremost, who was within a few yards of our men, brandishing his sword and then pointing towards them, with a loud voice said to the troops, "Fire, by God, fire," which was instantly followed by a discharge of arms from the said troops, succeeded by a very heavy and close fire upon our dispersing party, so long as any of them were within reach. John Robbins agreed with the minister, stating, "The foremost of these three officers ordered their men, saying, 'Fire, by God, fire,' at which moment we received a very heavy and close fire from them." Even John Bateman, a British soldier with the 52nd Regiment of Foot, declared, "He was in the party marching to Concord, that I heard the words of command given to the troops to fire, and some of the troops did fire." Although the source of the shot will never be known, what happened next is, the light infantry began to fire either with or without orders. Upon hearing the report of a pistol or gun, then the regulars huzzaed and fired, first two more guns, then the advance guard, and then the whole body. At first, the militiamen of Lexington thought the regulars were firing blanks. Yet when Elijah Sanderson saw a light infantryman fire at a man behind a stone wall, he observed the wall smoke with bullets hitting it. Ebenezer and John Monroe also believed the troops were firing only powder until Ebenezer was wounded in the arm. Angered by his injury, the militiamen returned fire, screaming, "I'll give them the guts of my gun." With the volley, the spectators gathered along the edges of the town common, broke and ran. Timothy Smith, who was watching the events unfold, recalled that he immediately ran and a volley was discharged at me, which put me in imminent danger of losing my life. Thomas Fessenden later testified, "I ran off as fast as I could." Benjamin Tidd and Joseph Abbott of Lincoln lost control of their horses, as did Lieutenant Sutherland, whose horse bolted, carrying him through the ranks of the fleeing militia and several hundred yards down Bedford Road. The regulars continued to fire, made a huzza, and charged furiously towards the retiring militia. As the light infantry surged forward, Ebenezer Monroe remembered Jonas Parker, with his balls and flint in his hat, on the ground between his feet, and heard him declare that he would never run. He was shot down at the second fire. I saw him struggling on the ground, attempting to load his gun. As he lay on the ground, they ran him through with the bayonet. John and Ebenezer Monroe also returned fire. According to John Monroe, he retreated 10 rods, fired, and then reloaded, ramming 2 lead balls down the barrel of his musket. The force of the charge took off a foot of his musket's barrel. Ebenezer Monroe believed that there was no chance for escape and that I might as well fire my gun as stand still and do nothing. In an interview with the Reverend Gordon, James Brown stated that he being got over the wall and seeing the soldiers fire pretty freely, he fired upon them and others did the same. According to Lieutenant Tidd, he retreated up the North Road and was pursued about 30 rods by an officer on horseback. I found that I could not escape him unless I left the road. Therefore, I sprang over a pair of bars, made a stand, and discharged my gun at him, upon which he immediately returned to the main body. Solomon Brown ran across Bedford Road, hopped over a stone wall, and fired at the regulars. When the regulars returned fire, the young man ran into Buckman Tavern through the back door. Once inside, he sprinted over to the front door, kicked it open, and fired 2 more shots. Believing that Brown's actions would lead to the tavern being burned to the ground, tavern owner John Buckman physically ejected Brown from the establishment, forcing him to seek cover in the woods. Yet very few militiamen actually returned fire. Nathaniel Mullican stated, "Not a gun was fired in our company on the regulars." A year later, the Reverend Clark strongly asserted, "Far from firing first upon the king's troop, upon most careful inquiry, it appears that very few of our people returned fire at all, and even they did not fire till after being fired upon by the troops." Several militiamen would actually testify later, "We attended to the beat of our drum and were formed on the parade. We were faced toward the regulars, then marching up to us. And some of our company were coming to the parade with their backs towards the troops, and others on the parade began to disperse when the regulars fired on the company before a gun was fired by any of our company on them." The British sustained only 3 light injuries. On the other hand, the toll was very heavy for the Lexington training band. 8 men were killed and 11 more were wounded in the brief encounter. John Brown and Samuel Hadley were both shot in the back as they ran from the common. Jonathan Harrington was mortally wounded only a few yards from his home. Tragically, his wife watched as he desperately crawled towards them. Woburn's Asahel Porter, who was taken prisoner early in the morning, was killed as he tried to flee from his captors. Caleb Harrington was killed as he exited the town meeting house when the skirmish started. Joseph Comey was wounded in the arm as he also tried to escape the building. Remaining inside the meeting house, Joshua Simons retreated to the upper loft where the town's supply of gunpowder was stored and thrust his loaded weapon into a barrel of powder. If the regulars attempted to storm the building, he was determined to destroy it. As the slaughter continued, Isaac Muzzy was killed and 10 more militiamen were wounded, including enslaved person Prince Esterbrook. In the space of 5 minutes, nearly 1/3 of the members of Captain John Parker's company who had mustered on the common had become casualties. When Lieutenant Colonel Smith arrived on the scene, the bodies of the dead and wounded militiamen littered the field. His troops were firing in every direction, and some were even preparing to storm the meeting house in nearby homes. Major Pitcairn was desperately attempting to regain control, swinging his sword downwards with all the earnestness as a signal to forbear or cease fire. Smith realized that order must be restored, and he began to search for a drummer to sound the recall. He approached Lieutenant Sutherland, asked him, "Do you know where a drum is, which I found?" who immediately beat to arms. The men ceased firing, and sullenly returned to ranks. Smith gathered his officers around him. At the conclusion of the meeting, the officers and regulars resumed their march to Concord. At some point in the moments after the battle, at least 5 British regulars who had fallen behind the main column appeared along the British road. These soldiers were immediately set upon and forced to surrender. They were stripped of their muskets and equipment and marched to the common. Later in the morning, the soldiers were transferred under guard to James Reed's residence in Woburn. The captured muskets and equipment were redistributed by Ebenezer Monroe to other Lexington militiamen. By mid-morning, residents of Lexington buried their dead in a makeshift grave. Meanwhile, Captain Parker assembled his men on the village common. According to local folklore, the company marched westward as fifer Jonathan Harrington played the White Cockade. When the Lexington Company arrived at the Lexington-Lincoln town border around 12:30 in the afternoon, Parker signaled his company to halt and then instructed his men to prepare for an ambush. Absent from the company was the confusion and hesitation of the earlier encounter with the British regulars. More than anyone else on that day, Captain John Parker's company wanted revenge. The Lexington Company selected a position near the Tabitha Nelson homestead. This site included a house, barn, farmyard, orchard, and woodlot. Adjacent to the homestead was a ledge that overlooked the property. There were also several outbuildings, such as privies, sheds, and chicken coops, dispersed throughout the property. Dozens and dozens of boulders of various sizes dotted the farmland. Along the eastern and southern boundaries of the property was a geological seep. A small bridge that was part of the Concord Road crossed over it. The majority of Parker's men broke ranks and formed a long, staggered skirmish line along an elevated finger of land inside the woodlot overlooking the footbridge. The Nelson homestead offered several tactical advantages to Captain Parker and his men. The bridge would be a point of constriction for the British retreating forces. The retreating British forces would have to slow down to cross the structure and would be more vulnerable to an attack. The boulders, structures, and trees provided ample coverage and could serve as obstacles to a British counterassault. From their vantage point, Parker's company had a clear view down Concord Road. Not only would the militia have heard the battle coming towards them, but from their elevated position, they could watch the British approach from Concord heading back towards Boston. Finally, there was an accessible route that ran through the woodlot. The pathway not only provided an easy access point for withdrawal, but also permitted the men to re-engage the retreating column further east at the Bloody Bluff and Fisk Hill. Around 1 o'clock in the afternoon, Parker likely received information that the regulars were approaching his position. Already, the sound of musket fire could be heard in the distance. As the British column approached, they had been marching and fighting for over 12 hours. The regulars were running out of water and ammunition, and discipline in the British column was quickly breaking down. According to Captain William Souter of the Marines, Lieutenant Colonel Smith was exposed to a continuous barrage of musket fire that they did not anticipate. By the time the retreating column had reached the Nelson homestead, the British had suffered almost 100 casualties. The retreating soldiers' pace had likely slowed down significantly because it was now encumbered with scores of wounded soldiers and officers that clung to horses, carts, carriages, or whatever else might help them reach Boston. When the British column reached the bridge, Smith's column was suddenly in a dangerous position. The soldiers entered the lowest point of a valley along the steep feature while the Lexington militia held an elevated position. The head of the column likely caught sight of the Lexington men. In response, a vanguard composed of British light infantry quickly formed along the steep, remained clustered together as they crossed the bridge, and started to deploy towards Parker's position in a close, tight formation. This offered an excellent target for the Lexington militia. Parker waited until the soldiers were within 50 yards of his position before ordering his men to fire. The Lexington men then unleashed a volley that swept along the vanguard, instantly killing or wounding a number of regulars. Lieutenant Colonel Smith was struck in the thigh, and Captain Parson of the 10th Regiment of Foot was hit in the arm. The British light infantry struggled to complete its deployment, halted, and then fired at the militia. Two Lexington men, Jedediah Monroe and Nathan Wyman, were struck and killed immediately after discharging their muskets. The regulars swept up the slope. However, Parker and his men had already started to withdraw. After discharging a single volley, the militiamen quickly retired up the access path at the top of the hill and then moved down the east side. Once at the bottom, the company moved to a new position down the road to attack the column again. According to militiaman Nathan Monroe, "We fired on them and continued to do so until they met their reinforcements in Lexington." The British vanguard did not pursue the militiamen and returned to the column. Once the Lexington militia withdrew from its position, Major Pitcairn ordered the light infantry company of the Royal Marines up onto a small hill known only as the Bluff. As the Marines provided cover, the Major quickly pushed the remainder of the column past Bull Tavern and behind the protection of the hill. Although Pitcairn was able to relieve the pressure of the provincials, the delay allowed the colonists time to take up fortified positions on neighboring Fisk Hill. As the exhausted regulars struggled up the hill, the provincials closed in on the column. In the ensuing skirmish, Major Pitcairn was unhorsed and injured. Six regulars and two provincials were killed, and several on both sides were wounded. At the height of the fight, a panic set in amongst the British regulars. Some began to surrender or desert, while others broke into a flight. The frightened soldiers ignored the orders of their officers and made no attempt to return fire. In full retreat, the ragged column struggled up Concord Hill, the last height before reaching Lexington's center. Sensing disaster, several officers placed themselves in the front of the column, leveled their bayonets at their men, and told them that if they broke ranks, they would die. Some semblance of order was quickly restored, but as several British officers later admitted, the entire force was at that point on the verge of complete surrender. As the beleaguered column marched down Concord Hill, and with Lexington Common just coming into view, the sound of wild cheering came from the regulars. Rushing to the front, the officers saw the ranks of Lord Hugh Earl Percy's relief column drawn up on the hills beyond Lexington Center. Over 1,200 strong, Earl Percy's command consisted of all the line companies of four regiments, two gun crews of the Royal Artillery, and at least seven Loyalist guides. As Smith's column pushed towards the relief column, a puff of smoke and a loud boom erupted from one of the two cannons attached to Percy's forces. Seconds later, there was a crash of splintering wood as the ball tore through the Lexington's meeting house, scattering nearby militia and minutemen. Colonel Smith's battered and exhausted troops hurried into the protective lines of Lord Percy's forces drawn up on the ridge near Monroe's Tavern. Once there, the soldiers of the morning's expedition collapsed, crawling under trees and shrubs to rest in the shade while regimental surgeons attended to the many wounded. Hundreds of exhausted light infantrymen and grenadiers rested on the tavern lawn. Inside the establishment, nearly every room was filled with casualties. In the taproom, rowdy soldiers began to drain the bar dry, demolished it, and then murdered John Raymond by shooting him in the back as he tried to flee the establishment. The total damage done to the tavern was approximately £203, 11 shillings and 9 pence. After Smith's expedition arrived, both of Percy's flanks became engaged in a sniper's war. Along the left flank, provincials crawled close enough to the British lines to fire upon the officers and sergeants of the Royal Welsh Fusiliers. Lord Percy wrote later, "Nor are several of their men void of a spirit of enthusiasm, as we experienced, for many of them advanced within 10 yards to fire at me and other officers, though they were morally certain of being put to death themselves in an instant." The tactic proved successful for the provincials. The regulars were forced to pull in their lines and bring up their own sharpshooters as a countermeasure. Along the right flank, the situation was worse. When the 47th Regiment of Foot failed to occupy Esterbrook Hill, the provincials took advantage of the opportunity to seize the high ground and began to fire on the exposed troops below. As lead balls began to rain down, the 47th suffered an increasing number of casualties. At the center of Percy's battle line, near Monroe's Tavern, the general observed that several homes offered excellent fields of fire for rebel snipers. The commander quickly ordered the structures to be burned and dispatched men to perform the task. By 3 o'clock in the afternoon, the provincials sensed Percy would soon begin to retreat back to Boston. The individual snipers pulled back, and large numbers of militia and minutemen took their places along the flanks into the front and rear of the column. Half an hour later, Percy ordered his troops to move out. It took over 30 minutes to assemble the entire brigade on the Boston Road. As the brigade moved out, the colonists attacked the flanks and rear of the retiring column. According to one British officer's account, "As soon as they saw us begin to retire, they pressed very much upon our rear guard, which for that reason I relieved every now and then. In this manner we retreated, under an incessant fire all round us." In response to this circle of fire, the British flanking party set upon any house they encountered along the path of retreat. Residences were fired upon, stormed, looted, and then torched. Although some remained standing, the Lexington homes along Boston Road beyond Monroe Tavern were left scarred with extensive damage. 2 miles further on, the column of regulars finally left Lexington. For unknown reasons, perhaps because of the wake of destruction the regulars had left behind, it is suspected that Parker's men ceased pursuing the regulars at the Lexington-Monotomy line. As the echoes of muskets softened, the men of Lexington slung their muskets over their shoulders, wiped the gunpowder from their faces, and went home to survey the damage caused by the regulars. In the days following the battles of Lexington and Concord, Dr. Joseph Fisk traveled from house to house in Lexington, as well as along the British retreat route, tending to British and American wounded. On April 23, 1775, representatives from the Massachusetts Provincial Congress arrived in Lexington and deposed members of the Lexington militia as to the events surrounding the Battle of Lexington. In the months and years after the Battle of Lexington, 106 men, including the slave Prince Esterbrook, enlisted in the Continental Army and fought for the cause of independence, from Canada to New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey. Many died, but most returned home safely. Those men who did not enlist were still obligated by law to serve in the town militia. In times of crisis, a certain percentage of men from each Massachusetts militia company were called upon to serve temporarily in militia regiments. Throughout the war, the Lexington Training Band not only served as a home guard, but between 1776 and 1781, over 150 men from the town volunteered and saw service at Long Island, Saratoga, Rhode Island, Penobscot Bay, and New Bedford. As the years passed, the town of Lexington continued to suffer from the ravages of war. Within months of the commencement of the Siege of Boston, military hospitals were set up by American forces in Cambridge, Watertown, and Monotomy. Unfortunately, with a lack of effective quarantine regulations, camp fever, also known as typhus, spread from the American siege lines into the surrounding communities, including Lexington. This caused massive suffering and a rise in premature deaths, especially amongst children. Lexington was also devastated economically during the war. Shortly after the battles of Lexington and Concord, the colony of Massachusetts began to issue paper currency to support its war effort. In January 1777, the currency was worth approximately 19 shillings. By December of 1778, it had depreciated to less than 3 shillings. Complicating matters was a widespread shortage of common goods and supplies, including rum, leather, cloth, beef, and dairy products. This resulted in massive price inflation of supplies and services. In response to this growing economic crisis, the Massachusetts government ordered in July of 1778 a convention to convene in Concord, Massachusetts. Matthew Meade, Thaddeus Parker, and Joseph Files served as the representatives on behalf of Lexington. The convention recommended that the towns of Massachusetts adopt price-fixing measures on most goods and services, which the towns readily agreed to. In 1854, the last survivor of the Battle of Lexington, Pfeiffer Jonathan Harrington, died at the age of 96. At his funeral, more American soldiers marched than had fought at Lexington and Concord 79 years earlier. The last of those who had stood on Lexington Common that April morning in defense of liberty had now passed on. Thank you for joining us on the Season 1 finale of Historical Nerdery. To learn more about the battles of Lexington and Concord, as well as other neat information about Revolutionary New England, be sure to check out my website, historicalnerdery.com. Follow me on Facebook and Instagram, and subscribe to my mailing list. I'm Alex Kane, and this has been Historical Nerdery.